It's time for Security Now. Steve Gibson is here. We've got a patch for another Android Zero Day actively exploited vulnerability. We'll find out why President Biden says, yikes, quantum computing. And we'll find out what this new FIDO initiative with Apple, Google, and Microsoft means. Is it more secure? Stay tuned. Security Now is next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 870, recorded Tuesday, May 10th, 2022. That passkeys thing. This episode of Security Now is brought to you by Zentry Security. Remote work is here to stay. Zentry Security's Zero Trust Private Access Solution is a modern cloud-hosted alternative to a VPN. Enhance your security posture today. Try Zentry Trusted Access with a 30-day free trial by visiting zentrysecurity.com/twit. And by Collide. Get endpoint management that puts the user first. Visit collide.com/security now to learn more and activate a 14-day free trial today. No credit card required. And by privacy.com. Privacy lets you buy things online using virtual cards instead of having to use your real ones, protecting your financial identity on the internet. Right now, new customers will automatically get $5 to spend on their first purchase when you go to privacy.com/security now to sign up today. It's time for Security Now, the show where we cover your security, your privacy, your safety, how computers work. Anything else Steve wants to talk about, including science fiction, here he is, ladies and gentlemen, Steve Gibson.
Hi, Steve. And we will have a little sci-fi segue, since if you did see it, as you said you were going to.
I did.
Tonight,
we can talk about it. Yes. We will
talk about that. And today's main topic is a topic, close to my heart. I titled it That Passkeys Thing after what... The big announcement of what was World Password Day, it turns out, was not only that,
really?
But Cinco de Mayo. Yes. And this is sort of a non-announcement. I mean, it was okay. And in fact, because as you and I were talking before we began recording, I sort of have a dog in this hunt because I spent 7 years of my life designing a solution which FIDO is still working to solve. I thought, well, I didn't want to get myself involved, but it was the most tweeted thing of the past week.
Well,
so I thought,
yeah.
Well, okay. And if I hadn't invested 7 years in designing
Squirrel,
obviously I'd be talking about this.
Right.
So I shouldn't allow that to dissuade me from doing so.
Well, but you're an informed source. I was saying on MacBreak Weekly earlier, I really hope Steve fills us in on this.
Yeah. So we're going to look at a patch to Android to thwart an actively exploited vulnerability. We briefly revisit Connecticut's new privacy law, and we take a quick look at the raft of recent ransomware victims. Not in depth. I just kind of want to just say, look at what's happening. The U.S. State Department has added another ransomware group to its big bounty list. And we look at what's being called the biggest cybersecurity threat facing the United States. Meanwhile, the White House issues a memorandum about the threat from quantum computing, and we have the discovery of a new and pernicious DNS vulnerability that's unlikely to be fixed in our IoT devices. And after looking at F5 Network's new and quite serious troubles, we'll close the loop with some listener feedback, briefly discuss, or maybe not so briefly, because I think you and I will have some things to talk about, the past week of sci-fi news. Then we're going to finish by looking at the past week's most tweeted to me question. What's that passkeys thing that Apple, Google, and Microsoft are adopting?
The new FIDO Alliance thing. Yeah.
The new FIDO Alliance thing.
I can't wait.
We do have a wonderful picture of the week, thanks to somebody who knows that I appreciate what we would call physical humor.
It's quite the head scratcher.
It is.
I want to talk about our first sponsor before we get into the meat of the show. and remind you a little bit about the Colonial Pipeline hacking. Remember that? That was a case where the Colonial Pipeline was allowing employees and probably trusted third parties into their network. They were protecting themselves with a VPN. Employee left, had used an insecure password probably to begin with, and through a credential stuffing attack, the bad guys got in and brought down a major oil pipeline, a big infrastructure facility that was significant in ransomware annals. Where did they go wrong, you might ask? They went wrong because they didn't do zero trust, because they said, well, if you've got a VPN access, you must be okay. Have at it. Clearly not the solution. I've got a better solution for you. Zentry, Z-E-N-T-R-Y, Zentry Security. I think we now know remote work is here to stay. The pandemic sent people home. And of course, everybody suddenly knew what a VPN was, right? And started using them. But the VPN really was designed for a very different, probably somewhat less hostile environment, right? I remember my first VPN. I used to VPN at the radio station down in L.A., and I had the Cisco app that I had to put on my Mac and or my PC, and I had to log in to their VPN endpoint, and then I could get into the company network. Lies the problem. I could get into the company network. I could now wander around throughout the company network. They assumed, well, if you can get in, you must be an employee. Well, times have changed, right? Threat actors now are going after those remote workforces, and they're doing it with sophisticated phishing attacks. They exploit vulnerabilities in RDP. They're doing credential stuffing. And if your employee is the weakest link, you might be in trouble. VPNs, the problem is they offer broad network level access, right? Which allows east-west propagation for authorized users and unauthorized users. Zentry Security solves this. Instead of a VPN, you actually say this user has access to this application in the cloud, in the data center, no complex VPN clients. That's, by the way, another side benefit. It's a lot easier. There's not a lot of configuration, and without any headaches. You can give employees, contractors, third parties, regardless of their location, application-level access only to the specific apps and resources they need, based on globally applied natural language policies you define, the IT department defines. And it's very easy to find the rules. Think of it it's probably very similar to the firewall rules you're already writing. But it's very specific. It says, this employee XYZ has access to this app and this app and this cloud data, and that's it. Dispersed workforces get secured, and it is much easier to use for them. Streamlined access just to the applications they need to do their jobs. By the way, with a browser, no software for them to install on their preferred device. Every connection, yes, just like a VPN, encrypted end-to-end, which reduces the attack surface and increases your organization's security profile. So it's a perfect zero-trust solution. Everyone wins. Users love it. They don't see a whole list of things they can do. They only see the things that they want to do. Everyone's more productive. You can collaborate. IT has a lot less to support, and you have a lot less sleepless nights, a lot fewer sleepless nights, worrying about somebody wandering around in your network. I think it's a great idea. Enhance your security posture today. Try Zentry Trusted Access. 30-day free trial if you go right now to zentrysecurity.com/twit. Zentry. I think we couldn't do zentrysecurity.com/security because that would have been confusing. So it's zentrysecurity.com/twit. We thank them so much for supporting Security Now. And also, we thank you for supporting Security Now by using that address, zentrysecurity.com/twit. Thank you, Zentry. And now the picture of the week, Steve.
So this is a puzzler. For those who are not seeing the podcast or haven't seen the show notes, what we have is a roadway and a large wide sidewalk stretching across sort of a gorge. And on the sidewalk, like to the side, is a bridge, which is sort of the bridge to nowhere. It goes up and then it goes down. But you don't have to take the bridge because it just parallels the walking path. And, you know, and Leah, while you were telling us about Zentry, I was thinking maybe this is of historical significance. You know, this roadway and pedestrian way, it feels like, from what we can see on the left, like it's like bridging some gorge or a river or something.
Yeah.
Maybe once upon a time, that little walkway was like down below, going across the river, and they thought, well, for
Let's
historical reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe for the view. It gives you a better view of the whole.
Now that...
maybe. I don't know. If that were the case, you'd put it closer to the edge, though, wouldn't you?
It's not clear from any of the context of the photo where this is. I can't tell, like, what country it's in, but our listeners have quite a reach. So... I'm calling to our listeners. You may know, you may have walked past this bridge and thought to yourself, what?
What the heck? it looks like on these road signs, looks like there might be a Chinese.
There are like distant road signs in the background. So if anyone knows what this is, where it is, why it is, it would be interesting to find out, and I will certainly share that with you can almost read that.
See it. It's hard. It's either blurry or Chinese. I can't tell.
Anyway, so I love the caption that came with this. I tweaked it a little bit. So here we have this bridge, right, that just – it doesn't really do anything. You don't have to go up it. You could if you want, but, you're just going to get back to where you were. And so the caption reads for our audience, I mean for this topic – when you don't know what that code does, but you assume it must be important, so you just leave it alone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's don't like, take it out. Yeah.
You know, like, you might be afraid to remove this bridge, Leo, because it serves a mysterious purpose. Like, as you said, gazing into the hole from a better
altitude. You'll find
out,
for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but, better just, maybe give it a little bit of leeway and just say, well, okay, fine. We're not going to, you could change your mind. Today I'll take the bridge. Tomorrow I won't. Either way, you end up in the same place. Anyway, thank you to our listener who said, okay, Gibson, you're going to like this one. Google updated Android to patch an actively exploited vulnerability, not for the first time. This was just their monthly security patch release. It fixed 37 flaws across various components. One of them is a fix to an actively exploited Linux kernel vulnerability that came to light earlier this year. It was a little odd that it took them as long as it did. That vulnerability is CVE-2021. That's, last year's CVE number, 22600. It has a CVSS of 7.8, ranked as high severity because it could be exploited by a local user to escalate privileges or deny service. And as we know, especially in the Android ecosystem, where it's not that difficult for malware to be running on your phone, right? I mean, like, people download this crap from the Google Play Store all the time saying, oh, look, it's going to improve your cell phone service and squeeze your memory down to give you more memory. And when you're not looking, it's going to polish your shoes. And someone says, hey, that sounds like a good idea. I want some of that. And so they download it. Well, the app is constrained by Linux's security rings, right? Unless the app knows about this CVSS 7.8 it's a high severity exploit, which allows it to escalate its privileges to root and root around in your phone. So the flaw was a double free vulnerability residing in the packet network protocol implementation in the Linux kernel. And, it's kernel-wide, so not really just Android. It could cause memory corruption, potentially leading to at least denial of service, or, if you're a clever hacker, execution of arbitrary code. And as I said, it wasn't just Android that was vulnerable. Patches were released by various Linux distros, including Debian, Red Hat, SUSE, and Ubuntu, back in late 2021 in December and also early 2022 in January. And it's unclear why Google didn't patch this one sooner. Maybe Jay just figured, well, as far as we know, it's not being used. So anyway, now it is. And so now they did. They said there are indications that CVE-2021-22600 may be under limited targeted exploitation. Last month, this vulnerability was added to CISA's known exploited vulnerabilities catalog due to evidence of its active exploitation in the wild. Google also patched 3 other bugs in the kernel, as well as 18 other high severity and also 1 critical severity flaw, which was in the MediaTek and Qualcomm components. So, you know, update. This you're gonna actually a couple stories today. We're gonna have some fun with this issue of updating, because come on, folks. Okay, Connecticut's recently passed data privacy bill became law last Wednesday. I talked about it last Tuesday. I was incorrect in stating last week that Connecticut's governor, Ned Lamont, would need to sign the recently passed legislation for it to become law. That's normally the way it works. It turns out that the state, Connecticut, has a rule that bills which have been passed in the state assembly become law automatically 5 days after they're passed when during a legislative session. So that seems like an expeditious thing to have. We ought to all have one of those. So consequently, Connecticut now joins California, Virginia, Colorado, and Utah to become the 5th state to create its own privacy law in lieu, and because the federal government isn't doing anything about this. And there has been a specific reaffirmation that once that law has ramped up to full strength, that global privacy control signal that we talked about last week, which will now or soon be sent by browsers, must be honored, and specifically without exception and without any further "are you sure?" style prompting by anyone with whom Connecticut residents interact online. So, you know, the point being that no one gets hassled with this like you are now with cookies. You know, if you're sending that GPC signal, the browser cannot by law challenge you about that.
Yay.
It just has to say, okay. and go with it.
By the way, Web4849 in our chat room has discovered the location of this bridge to nowhere. It is in Korea, the Dongan Bridge. And in Songnam City, and it apparently is intended to not go anywhere. When walking along the 72-meter-long bridge, passersby can choose to walk straight on, or if they, quote, had a little more strength in their legs or a little more time, they could opt to cross over an overpass to get from one end to the other. You could also observe from it the Pangyo Techno Park.
Leo, you got it. You get. It's an observation point, and when they call it an overpass, we should note that it's not passing over anything.
Except sidewalk. apparently well known in Korea. And thank you to one of our chatters, Web4849,
who fantastic.
Took I love seconds, the, mere seconds to
love
find
the
that.
Reach of our listeners. Let me think of other things I don't know.
Yes, and
we could ask some other questions. Okay, I promise not to dwell at length, you know, ad infinitum on ransomware attacks. But my concern is that in honoring that promise to the letter, we're downplaying it. So I decided, okay, from time to time, I'm just going to kind of give people a sense for it. So, for example, Trinidad's largest supermarket chain was crippled by an attack. The German Library Service is struggling to recover from a ransomware attack. A major German wind farm operator confirms a cybersecurity incident, which was ransomware. Austin, PA State University in the U.S. was hit with ransomware. The ADA, that is our American Dental Association, confirmed a cyber attack after ransomware group claimed credit. Coca-Cola is investigating claims of a hack after a ransomware group was offering their stolen data for sale. Oops. Conti ransomware has deeply crippled the systems of the electricity manager in a Costa Rican town, and the newly elected president of Costa Rica has since declared a state of emergency as a consequence. The agricultural equipment maker AGCO has reported a ransomware attack. A cyber attack has taken down the network at the State Bar of Georgia. And classes have resumed at Michigan Community College after a ransomware attack, and classes at Kellogg Community College will be resuming tomorrow after 2 days of outages caused by a ransomware attack. In Battle Creek, Michigan, nearly 7,000 students were told last Monday, May 2nd, that ransomware had crippled its systems the previous Friday, April 29th. The school was forced to shut down its main campus in Battle Creek, as well as branches in Coldwater, Albion, and Hastings. So there's your
good
your
Lord.
Snippet.
What it tells you is it's so commonplace now that it's not worthy of note. Right?
Yes, it's just like it's bad and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. But I just wanted to sort of like put a little punctuation on this.
Jeez.
It is not, because I'm not talking about it, it doesn't mean it isn't happening.
Oh, no.
And that this isn't like a really big problem. And which leads us to our next story. The U.S. State Department offering a $10 million reward for information about Conti members. The U.S. State Department has begun offering $10 million rewards, plural, for it. So it's not just a first take, first come, first serve. There'll be a line for any information leading to the identification or location of people connected to the Conti ransomware gang. And in addition, you can get an additional $5 million reward if any information you provide does lead to the arrest or conviction of a Conti member. So a total of $15 million to anyone who can turn in a member of the Conti gang. And, you know, this is U.S. dollars, 10 million, 15 million of them. You got to think that this would make anybody associated with Conti quite uncomfortable. You know, there must be others outside of the immediate gang who are not themselves criminals, so they don't face prosecution, but to whom members of Conti have bragged about, you know, like just, you know, over drinks or, you know, who, you know, you know, I keep trying to say pillow talk, but no. So, you know, in a statement on Friday, State Department spokesman Ned Price told us something we already know, that Conti has been behind hundreds of ransomware attacks over the last several years. He said, quote, the FBI estimates that as of January 2022, there had been over 1,000 victims of attacks associated with Conti ransomware, with victim payouts exceeding $150 million. Making the Conti ransomware variant the costliest strain of ransomware ever documented. The memo also notes that the group has recently claimed credit for that wide-ranging ransomware attack that targeted the government of Costa Rica as it was transitioning to a new president. The attack crippled the country's customs and taxes platforms alongside several other government agencies. And as I noted before, the attack also brought down one Costa Rican town's energy supplier. Conti also attacked, as we have documented at the time, Ireland's health service executive a year ago, back in May of 2021, which resulted in weeks of disruption at the country's hospitals. Ireland refused to pay the $120 million ransom and now estimates it may end up spending $100 million recovering from the attack. Although, as I recall, Leo, I think that was the one where they were like going to get all new computers as a result. So it was like,
Yeah, nice.
Maybe they're milking their insurance company a little harder than they
should. Who gets the old computers? That's what I want to know.
The group similarly crippled dozens of hospitals in New Zealand, and the group has made a point of targeting U.S. healthcare and first responder networks. They're not nice. Oh, and they're Russian, by the way. Including law enforcement agencies, emergency medical services, 911 dispatch centers, and municipalities within the last year, so says the FBI. The group has suffered a number of internal breaches over the years, the most notable of which occurred a few months ago in February, after it expressed public support for Russia's, no surprise, invasion of Ukraine. Within a few days of the message, the gang's internal Jabber, you know, XMPP server, which carried their private messaging channel, was hacked, and 2 years of the chats of the group's chat logs appeared on a new Twitter handle called Conti Leaks. The leaks revealed the group's inner workings and illustrated the way they chose their targets. However, those leaks did nothing to slow the group down. Last Wednesday, they added New York-based architecture firm EYP to their list of victims. So, Conti now joins the ranks of those carrying a serious bounty on their heads. Last November, the U.S. State Department offered a $10 million reward for any information that would lead to the identification and/or arrest of members of the DarkSide ransomware group, with a similar bounty on the operators behind Reval, also, you know, the Sodino Kibi malware. So this is an interesting tactic that I have to imagine it would be effective. U.S. dollars are valued globally. Still, fortunately, and again, if nothing else, you have to imagine that this, you know, would weigh on the minds of anyone choosing to participate. If they get in, they've got to be very circumspect within their own social sphere, because, you know, here's the U.S. dangling $10 million just for turning you in. And that's real money.
So frustrating. One of our chatters just sent me a link to a Bleeping Computer article about a college in Illinois, Lincoln College, one of the historically black colleges in rural Illinois, closing after 157 years. It survived a major fire in 1912, the Spanish flu, the Great Depression, two world wars, the 2008 global financial crisis. But after 2 years of pandemic and finally getting hit by ransomware, they decided to shut down after 157 years. That is horrific and tragic. Just tragic. A cyber attack in December that thwarted admission activities, hindered access to all institutional data, creating an unclear picture of this fall enrollment. And so they're shutting them down.
Wow. Well, and we've covered when the ransomware was attacking the healthcare industry, it was clearly damaging the lives of people. People were being hurt by the healthcare providers.
So sad. Now they're going after schools.
Yep. Ugh. Yep. Okay. So what's the worst threat the U.S. faces? It's from the WINTI group, W-I-N-N-T-I, the WINTI group, also known as APT-41. APT, of course, is Advanced Persistent Threat. Just how advanced and persistent are these threat actors? Researchers with Cyber Reason recently briefed the FBI and the DOJ about Operation Cuckoo Bees. Funny name, not a funny operation. This is an ongoing espionage effort by Chinese state-sponsored hackers with the charter to steal proprietary information from dozens of global defense, energy, biotech, aerospace, and pharmaceutical companies. The specific individual organizations affected were not named in Cyber Reason's report, but they allegedly include some of the largest companies in North America, Europe, and Asia. And the threat actor behind it all is the prolific Winty Group, also known as APT-41. Cyber Reason's CEO, Lior Div, said that the most alarming aspect of the investigation into Operation Cuckoo Bees was the evasive and sophisticated measures used to hide inside the networks of dozens of the largest global manufacturing companies in North America, Europe, and Asia, dating back as far as 2019. Lior said, quote, "The group operates like a guided missile, and once it locks onto its target, it attacks and doesn't stop until it steals a company's crown jewels. Winty pilfered thousands of gigabytes of data, and to add insult to injury, also made off with proprietary information on business units, customer and partner data, employee emails, and other personal information for use in blackmail or extortion schemes at a time of their choosing," unquote. Cyber Reason said that throughout its 12-month investigation, it found the intruders took troves of intellectual property and sensitive proprietary data, including formulas, source code, R&D documents, and blueprints, as well as diagrams of fighter jets, helicopters, missiles, and more. And remember, China. The attackers also gained information that could be leveraged for use in future related cyber attacks, like details about a company's business units, network architecture, user accounts and credentials, employee emails, and customer data. This group gets in your network, you're hosed, basically. And of greatest concern, according to Cyber Reason CEO, was that the companies had no clue they had been breached. In a pair of detailed reports, Cyber Reason attributes the attacks to Winty based on an analysis of the digital artifacts the group left behind after its intrusions. Several other cybersecurity companies have also been tracking Winty since it first emerged 12 years ago in 2010, and researchers have observed that the hackers are clearly operating on behalf of China state interests while specializing in cyber espionage and intellectual property theft. The group used a previously unknown and undocumented malware strain called DeployLog, as well as new versions of malware like SpiderLoader, PrivateLog, and WinNT Kit. The malware included digitally signed kernel-level rootkits, as well as an elaborate multi-stage infection chain that enabled the operation to remain undetected. The group also managed to abuse the Windows Common Log File System, CLFS, which allowed the intruders to conceal their payloads and evade detection by traditional security products. CLFS is a logging framework that was first introduced by Microsoft in Windows Server 2003 R2 and has been included in all subsequent Windows OSs. Cyber Reason explained that, quote, "The attackers implemented a delicate house of cards approach," that was their term, "meaning that each component depends on the others to execute properly, making it very difficult to analyze each component separately. And unsurprisingly, Operation Cuckoo Bees generally took advantage of existing weaknesses, including unpatched systems, Yes, thank you. Insufficient network segmentation, unmanaged assets, forgotten accounts, and lack of multi-factor authentications. In other words, stupid oversights.
Yeah, easily remedied.
Yes, exactly. Cyber Reason said that the attackers generally obtained their initial foothold in the organizations through vulnerabilities in enterprise resource planning, ERP platforms. Last month, FBI's director Christopher Wray told 60 Minutes that the biggest threat American law enforcement officials face is from Chinese hackers stealing proprietary information. He said that the FBI opens a new China counterintelligence investigation about every 12 hours.
Oh, my God.
Think about that.
Oh, my God.
Every 12 hours, another new Chinese counterintelligence investigation is opened by the FBI. Wray said that, quote, they are targeting our innovation, our trade secrets, our intellectual property on a scale that's unprecedented in history. They have a bigger hacking program than that of every other major nation combined.
Wow.
They have stolen more of Americans' personal and corporate data than every other nation combined. It affects everything from agriculture to aviation to high tech to healthcare, pretty much every sector of our economy. Anything that makes an industry tick, they target, unquote.
There is a difference, though, between this and the ransomware gangs we were talking about earlier, which are actually trying to steal from companies and bring them to their knees. This sounds like it's intellectual property theft.
Yes.
That the Chinese hackers aren't trying to destroy us or destroy our industry. They're just trying to find out how we make things so they can make them cheaper, things like that. And admittedly, there's an economic consequence to that. But that's not nearly as offensive as the Conti Group, right? Or am I wrong?
Well, when you're digging into our military-industrial complex.
Well, if they go after the military, you're right. That's different.
They're in there.
Yeah.
They're in.
But
that's where
if the military's
going.
Getting hacked because they haven't patched and they're not using two-factor, we have other reasons to be upset.
And, Leo, we have other reasons to be upset.
Yes. And we're going to get upset about something else in a minute, I'm sure.
We are.
You know, we're a good team, Steve, because you scare the pants off our audience. And then I show up with the solution. It's
exactly.
Perfect. That's why we have so many security advertisers like Collide, which is a really cool idea, by the way. I want to tell you about. I presume you're ready for a break.
Perfectly
I'm not stealing
fine.
This away from you.
Nope.
Okay. Collide had a great idea. So many businesses, ours included, use Slack to communicate, right? Also, there's this problem, which is a lot of times, and I think we've learned this lesson, IT departments, they come in, they lock stuff down, right? That's the sensible thing to do. Fill all the USB ports with crazy glue and stuff like that. But there is a problem because the users aren't too happy because they're being forced to do stuff. They don't understand. They don't really understand what the issues are. And then what happens is users start using their own stuff, their own devices. They all have laptops. They say, well, my laptop is so locked down by IT, I'm going to use my own. And that now we have a whole nother kettle of fish. Wouldn't it be great if you could get endpoint management that users bought into, that they understood, that they said, yeah, I'm going to do that. That's a good idea. It's possible, and that's what Collide has. It's a new take on endpoint management that asks the question, how can we get end users more involved? The old school device management, MDM, locking down your devices without considering employees' needs or even, attempting to educate them about why you're doing what you're doing or enroll them as your support. You know, imagine if your security team was expanded to include every employee in the enterprise? Wouldn't that be great? Well, that's what Collide does. It's built by like-minded security practitioners who in the past have seen just how much MDM was disrupting end users and how often end users would get so frustrated they just switch to personal laptops and not tell anyone. And that is even worse. Collide is different. Instead of locking down a device, Collide takes a user-focused approach. Now, I know this is sometimes hard to get by, especially some of the old-school IT folks. User-focused, not on my watch. What do they know? But you see, if you can get your users to be part of your security force, it's so much better. What happens is Collide communicates security recommendations to your employees right there on Slack in a friendly way. Look at the Collide webpage. There's some very good examples of this. So instead of locking down a device, as Collide has said, in fact, they'll experience Collide right at the very first because it says, okay, it's a guided process. Let's install Collide. It starts with the end users installing the endpoint agent on their own. Okay, come on, we're going to install Collide together. I know sometimes we say, oh, no, you can't let the end users do this. But honestly, if you can get them to go along, your job is much, much easier. Security goes from being, we say what goes and that's that, a black and white kind of state to dynamic conversation. And so the first Slack message they get from Collide says, okay, let's install this endpoint agent. Here's why you need it. From there, Collide regularly sends employees recommendations anytime their device is in an insecure state. So if, for instance, they take off the password on their screen lock, then they'll get a message saying, hey, I see you don't have a password on screen lock. Let's set that up. Because that way, somebody can't come over and use your machine while you're at lunch. That kind of thing. Nuanced issues that are hard sometimes for us to communicate. Although if you listen to this show, you probably have some pretty good ideas. But things like asking people to secure two-factor backup codes because they just left them in their download folder in plain text. That kind of. And we'll actually notice that. And it will send them a message saying, hey, I notice you've got this file in your download folder that has all your passwords, your two-factor keys in there. You might want to do something about that. Can we help? Can we do that? Let's do that together. Because it's talking directly to employees, Collide is educating them about the company's policies and how to keep their devices secure using real, tangible examples. These aren't theoretical scenarios. They're things that are actually happening on that computer right now. Cross-platform, it works on Slack for Linux, Mac, and Windows. It puts end users first. If your team uses Slack, you gotta get Collide. Endpoint management that puts the user first. Collide. Collide.com/security now. You can learn more. You can activate a free 14-day trial. There's no credit card needed. Collide.com/security now. You'll also get a goodie bag of Collide swag after signing up for a new trial. Just some fun stuff, stickers, that kind of thing, mugs, T-shirts. I think it's a really, really good idea. I love this. Collide, collide.com/security now. That way your security team is everybody who works for you. Collide. All right, I'm ready to talk about quantum computing. And in fact, for a long time, I've been wanting to ask you how I see. I look at this, and it looks like Google and everybody. It's just a way to get money from the feds. Like they aren't really. Are we close?
No.
Okay.
So this one made me shake my head.
Okay.
The headline was White House wants nation to prepare for cryptography breaking quantum computers. Okay, to give everyone a sense for this, the reporting on the reporting on this, which appeared in The Record, started out saying a memorandum issued Wednesday by President Joe Biden orders federal agencies to ramp up preparations for the day when quantum computers are capable of breaking the public key cryptography currently used to secure digital systems around the world. The document, National Security Memorandum 10, so of course we have to have initials, right? NSM 10, calls for a whole of government and whole of society strategy.
Well, let me get right on that. Whoa.
Yeah. for quantum information science, that's QIS, including the security enhancements provided by quantum resistant cryptography. Uh-huh.
So, that's one reason I switched from RSA to ESCD 50,000, whatever it is, the elliptic curve. I don't know what I'm doing, but that's why I changed my SSH keys, right? Is that more quantum resistant?
I was looking at this and I was thinking, okay, why don't we just cure cancer? And wait, that's what Biden was going to do Barack's VP. We were going to take that, do that. I don't know. How'd that work out? But seriously, okay.
ED25519, right? That's the keys I should use, right?
Yes.
Okay.
So he's ordering the federal government to ramp up preparations for a day when quantum computers are capable of breaking public key cryptography, which, by the way, doesn't yet exist.
Right.
The federal government.
And we don't know when it will exist, right?
No.
It's like fusion energy. Someday.
That's in the notes, Leo. Yes. The federal government is apparently unable to update its own software when being handed patches to do so.
That might be more important.
Someone somewhere says, not today. We haven't yet secured our computers for technology we already have against attackers we already have. So, I don't know. How about having the White House use a memorandum ordering the various agencies of the federal government to please just reboot their computers?
Even that would be a step forward.
How would that be? We would actually get more security right now today. If we did that, and as to your point, yes, sure, quantum computing technology shows promise, but let's remember that it's been showing promise for quite some time. We've had nascent quantum computing technology since around the late 1970s, so for more than four decades. It's intriguing and interesting, and it's been moving forward gradually. Like most really big problems do, and like fusion power, exactly like that. And the federal government should absolutely be funding ongoing research in universities to allow our nation's brightest young minds to continue pushing this frontier forward. There's clearly something tantalizingly possible there. And I agree that we should not forget that we have adversaries. As we know, China is also working hard on this problem. So, Leo, if we patch and reboot our computers, we might be able to keep them from stealing it once we figure it out.
Wow.
But yes.
Wow.
It absolutely is the case that at some point in the future, I think right now the most I saw was 4 qubits we were able to deal with. I kind of have a hazy sense that I saw something about more. But I mean, it doesn't scale linearly. If you get 4, you can't simply say, let's use 128 of those to get 512. No, they can't do that. So we are so far away from this actually being a threat. So I just scratched my head. It's like Joe Biden is issuing a memorandum telling us to scale up our preparedness when we cannot reboot our servers.
It's not a bad idea by itself, but it's not maybe the first thing we should do. There is, IBM says they've got 127 qubit device.
Ah, that may be what it was that I remember.
Yeah, IBM's selling these now. You can $1.60 per runtime second on their 27 qubit Falcon R5 processor. Maybe it's happening. I don't know. I don't know what you could do with 27 qubits. Can you?
Basically, you can absolutely simultaneously solve a symmetric crypto that uses an 8-bit key. I think is what it comes down to.
So we got to get to more than 1,000 qubits before.
Yes,
we're in trouble. Am I right saying that if I did ED2519 that
the technologies which do so the concern is that the one thing which has been protecting us the RSA crypto is that we don't know how to factor big numbers.
Right.
So the concern is a quantum computer could theoretically kill the factorization barrier.
Right.
That was the trap door. You can only go through one way. And the worry is that a quantum computer could just go, oh, you want to factor that? Here. I mean, like it doesn't even take any time. Just here.
Here.
You know?
Here's the factors.
It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
So we're wanting to get away from a crypto that is based on the multiplication of two primes that you're then unable to factor. Well, elliptic curve crypto is that.
Okay.
So
okay.
You get enough bits of elliptic curve crypto, and we're not worrying about factorization any longer.
I think I'm doing 512. No, 500.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's 521 bits for some reason. I don't know. I don't know what that means, but. Like I said, I just put in the formula. That's all.
That's good. And that's what's so easy about this. Like,
yeah.
And this has been the point I'm making. We have all the tools. All the toolkits are there. All the work has been done. The academic guys have pounded on it, and they've said, here you go. And so all it takes now is just plugging these in and using them correctly. And unfortunately, and not making any bad mistakes, which continues to dog us.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As I've often said, I am stunned by the elegance and fundamental simplicity of the internet's design. It was so beautifully conceived in the beginning, but as we know, it's not without a few blemishes. One of the original sins of the internet's early design was, and still is, a lack of entropy in some fields which are critically important. This entropy is crucially necessary for robust attack resistance. And in defense of the internet's early designers, the last thing they were thinking about while they were trying to get this whole thing to go was about active and aggressive adversaries. They were trying to keep coincidental things from causing a problem, which is very different from causing from preventing an active aggressor from leveraging their design to create mischief. That wasn't on their map at all. So they designed and built beautiful technology, which has, against all odds, withstood decades of explosive growth being put to use in applications they could never have and didn't ever imagine. But we got a few problems. For example, the endpoints of a TCP connection are identified only by an IP address and a port number. And the progress of the connection's data flow is tracked by a 32-bit sequence number. In the early days of this podcast, we examined how the predictability of the sequence numbers being issued by TCP/IP software stacks could be weaponized and used by attackers to splice into existing TCP connections. Since nothing identified the other endpoint other than its source IP address and source port, TCP packets carrying spoofed source IP and source port and guessing a sequence number that would be expected by the receiving endpoint could, and did back then, succeed in injecting malicious traffic into established TCP connections. Another quite famous lack of entropy may, and often does, exist in DNS queries. Being UDP, the spoofing task is much easier. If a DNS client emits a query to a DNS server having a knowable IP address, and if the 16-bit source port of its query and the 16-bit transaction ID are predictable, it's not difficult for an adversary to jam a bogus DNS reply back into that client, which looks identical to the reply it's expecting to receive from the authentic DNS server. And as we know, this form of DNS cache poisoning spoofing attack can have devastating consequences. The IP being looked up will be altered, and traffic will be silently redirected. It was the realization of that which hit Dan Kaminsky back in 2008, when nearly all DNS servers in the world were vulnerable to exactly that attack, because their queries had very low effective entropy. That caused the world to secretly prepare and then synchronize a simultaneous global update of all affected DNS servers. It was a great example of global coordination. But we missed something. Something that today afflicts many IoT devices, such as routers by Linksys Netgear and those loaded with OpenWRT firmware, as well as Linux distributions like Embedded Gentoo. This exposes many millions of IoT devices right now, today, once again, to this once-solved security threat. What we missed, or at least weren't worrying about 14 years ago, was that it's not only DNS servers and our desktop operating systems which emit DNS queries. They were all fixed. But many other low-end IoT-ish devices also emit DNS queries, and we forgot about them. Maybe it wasn't a big problem or concern back then, but the crucial fact is the lesson of the need to deeply randomize source port and transaction query IDs for DNS was not learned well enough. Nozomi Networks Labs discovered a vulnerability now being tracked as CVE-2022-3295. Which affects the DNS implementation of all versions of MicroC libc and MicroC libc -ng, which are very popular C standard library replacements used in many IoT products. You know, the C standard library is this big library, which is very capable, highly cross-platform. You can compile it just for about anything, but it's huge, and it does way more than a little IoT product with tight memory constraints needs. And for example, it supports memory mapping, which embedded IoT. There's a micro C Linux that specifically doesn't have memory management because a little embedded product isn't swapping stuff in and out of RAM. So this micro C libc and micro C libng are what embedded Linuxes use. The flaw, which was found and fixed in all major DNS servers back in 2008, is the predictability of transaction IDs in the DNS requests generated by the library. In the show notes, I have a picture of the code from MicroC libc, where we can see a variable local underscore ID plus plus semicolon. Well, that's a post increment operation, and since you're doing nothing but that on that particular instruction, it simply increments the value of local ID. The next line reads local underscore ID ampersand equals with 0xFFFF. Okay, so that masks the lower, masks and retains the lower 16 bits of the value local ID. So essentially what it does is local ID is incremented, and that and operation, then the logical and of the lower 16 bits deals with the overflow when it tries to go to a 17th bit. It discards that, so we wrap from 65535 back around to zero because those transaction IDs are 16 bits long. In other words, what this does, of course, is produce absolutely sequential DNS query transaction IDs. The problem that took the wind and the breath out of the entire network world 14 years ago is present in this library and apparently has been since its beginning. While I was doing a bit of background research into this micro C lib C, I found that the original pre-forked micro C lib C's last update was May 15th of 2012. So 10 years ago, exactly this coming Sunday. Because this library had become unsupported, it was forked to create micro C lib C hyphen NG, presumably NG stands for next generation. The good news is that one's being actively maintained. But under its home page's history section, talking about the history of micro C lib C NG, it explains. Micro C lib C NG is a spin-off of micro C lib C from Eric Anderson. And then from http://www.microclibc.org. Our main goal is to provide regularly, which in their write-up was misspelled, and a stable and tested release to make embedded system developers happy. The first release, 1.0.0, with the code name Lef Blonde, was made while visiting FOSDEM 2015. It was prepared in a hotel room in Brussels on the 1st of February 2015. All releases are prepared while drinking a pair of Belgian beer since then. Because, you know, Leo, that's what you want in the replacement for the standard C library that everyone's embedded IoT devices are using, is for it to be maintained by a drunken Belgian. The idea to fork micro C lib C started in July 2014, they wrote, and was discussed on the BuildRoot and OpenWRT mailing lists. Okay, so we've identified a well-understood flaw that has been present in embedded Linux-based IoT devices which use the micro C lib C library or the micro C lib C hyphen next generation library for the past decade or so. Apparently, no one thought to look before now. Now the world knows. I'm pretty sure that the OpenWRT folks will get on this and fix it because that's who they are. The fix, after all, is trivial. The transaction ID sequence simply needs to be unpredictable. And it needs to be unpredictable per instance of that device booting, right? You can't just like make a pseudo, like a fixed pseudo random sequence, because anyone can reverse engineer the firmware, see what the sequence is, and then go back to predictability. An embedded device without a good source of local entropy, which a really low-end, you know, IoT electric plug, for example, might have or might lack a good local source, could, you know, as it's starting up, use something like high-resolution packet timings to obtain an unpredictable seed. Send out some pings to some known static IPs and time their return at the device's full resolution clock speed. That will generate a value that's unknowable by any external attackers. I'd then use that value to key a simple symmetric cipher, which encrypts a sequential counter. That will produce a per power up, per boot, unpredictable sequence that no one on the outside can know. What we don't know is everywhere this embedded library has been used in embedded Linux systems. We don't know whether Netgear and Linux, which both use it, will care to update. And most importantly, where and how this flaw will surface in the future. But the bad guys will make it their business to know, because that knowledge is valuable to them. And this is the legacy we're building, which most worries me. The growing number of well-known problems that are accruing, mostly under the radar, and which are not being diligently fixed. These things don't go away on their own. They accumulate. What's happening over time, and mark my words, is that one of the favorite vehicles of fiction writers, which is that anything can be hacked, offensive as I have always found that idea, is gradually becoming true. Anything can be hacked. And this is another perfect example of the way it's going to happen, little by little and bit by bit. A problem like this, not, you know, that just doesn't really rise to the level of an, oh my God, run around, house on fire, like we saw with the DNS servers. But the same problem is in all the other little things that are making DNS queries and that could easily have their query poisoned by somebody who wanted to do that. That would relocate whatever traffic they were looking at to an attacker-controlled IP rather than where it should be going, and Lord knows then what mischief they can get up to. And you can't even count the hundreds of millions of devices running an embedded Linux that probably use this now known to be defective micro-C libc library. Well, we're not going to be running out of things to talk about, Leo. That's clear. F5 Networks Remote RCE. So here's another example of a serious vulnerability that's far more high profile and should get the attention of anyone using F5 Networks so-called Big Five or Big IP equipment. They've had problems before. We've talked about them before. But both we and the bad guys already know that patching is badly broken and that there will be F5 Big IP equipment online which remains unpatched. Remember that list of ransomware victims from earlier? This is exactly where attacks such as those begin. Last Wednesday on May 4th, F5, a major cloud security and application delivery network provider, released patches to repair 43 bugs spanning its products. Of the 43 issues they addressed, one is rated critical, this one, 17 are rated high, 24 medium, and one is rated low in severity. But that critical one, oh baby, it carries a CVSS of 9.8, which arises from a lack of an authentication check, which will allow attackers to take control of an affected system. As we're seeing more often now, the flaw took only a few days to reverse engineer, and a working proof of concept has been made public. So the use of the terms such as might, may, or could in F5's bureaucratically worded disclosure should be replaced with will, did, and have. They wrote, "This vulnerability may allow
an unauthenticated attacker with network access to the big five, to the big IP system through the management port and or self IP addresses to execute arbitrary system commands, create or delete files, or disable services. Uh-huh. And this security vulnerability appears to be long-standing, since it affects all six most recent major version release chains, version 11 through version 16. It doesn't appear that they'll be patching the oldest two major versions, 11 and 12, since patches for the iControl REST authentication bypass flaw have been released for versions 17.00, 16.122, 15.151, 14.146, and 13.15, leaving the 12-whatever and 11-whatever patched, vulnerable, but unpatched. So we can expect CISA to soon add an alert and a mandatory update commandment for this to their growing catalog of known exploited vulnerabilities. And in fact, they just added five more to that catalog, three for which patches were made available in 2014, one in 2019, and another last year. Yet all five are now under active exploitation, even 8 years in the case of those three that were patched in 2014 after having been patched. So, wow. We need to patch and reboot. Okay, a couple pieces of closing the loop feedback from our listeners. Someone whose name on Twitter is Let's Burninate. He said, Let's Burninate. Hi, Steve, longtime listener. He said, I just wanted to share this image. When I tried to change my PayPal password and was shocked by this error message for obvious reasons. And it is kind of entertaining. So this is I'm an avid PayPal user. They're a great solution for the problem that they're there to solve. So this is the change your password dialogue. And first they want you to confirm your current password. That's good. And he's done that. Then it says, enter your new password. Keep your account more secure. Don't use your name.
Good thinking. Okay.
Yeah. And then he put in a password, which it didn't like. And then it explained why. It turned it red with a red, emergency symbol. Your password can only contain letters, numbers, and these characters. And there's 10 of them. And I thought, what? They looked familiar to me. Sure enough, they are the shifted numeric characters on arranged
exclamation
keyboard.
Mark till left and right parenthesis. They leave out tilde for some reason. Interesting.
I don't have tilde in my.
Oh, it's to the left of what? You're right. It's just 1 through 0. You're right.
Yeah. So it's exactly the shifted 1 through 9 and 0 keys on our keyboard.
I see now, this a lot, I think.
So you can't do colon or semicolon, apostrophe or double quote. You can't use the curly braces or the squares. Apparently, you can't use dash, plus, undersign, or equals.
That's weird.
No tilde, no back apostrophe. Yeah. It's like no vertical bar or backslash. Why?
Why? Oh,
no forward slash, question mark. You can't use greater than or, I mean, they're like, they've discarded a whole bunch of really good ones.
Why?
So,
yeah, that's
anyway,
the question. Why?
Let's burninate. I agree with you. Let's burninate.
Let's burn it.
I don't
it's
get
a witch.
It.
Burn it.
Weird. Now, and I should note, if we didn't have browser-based hashing, then you'd have to think they were sending this back to, central headquarters.
Some guy.
Yeah. Who says, no. I don't know how to pronounce that squiggly one, so we're not going to have a tilde. Nobody knows what a tilde is. So it's like, okay, wow. Yeah. Again, there is no logic whatsoever.
Yeah.
to them excluding those. Auk, whose handle is at Adrian Terry, he said, RE, feedback on 869's Moxie's Knock Knock. He said, one can minimize their exposure of things on the internet without punching holes on their NAT routers. On 833, you mentioned a couple of more options to overlay networks other than Tailscale that might enable one, even on a home residential IP, to be able to interconnect their devices across the internet, even with their IPs changing. And Auk, you are absolutely right. I wanted to make sure I mentioned that. I thought that was, thank you for the tweet. He's, of course, right. This new class of so-called overlay networks, Hamachi was the first one that appeared, and now there's a whole bunch that are free in public domain and great-looking by all appearances. That is another way to allow a roaming device to participate in an overlay network, which is being maintained by some, like a machine on your network or a router on the border, and not have to do any sorts of hole punching. So, again, thank you. And then Bob Grant asked, "Hi, Steve. Thank you for your recommendation on McCollum," meaning Michael McCollum. He said, "Can you suggest a good starting point for reading him?" And I think I'd start with his Gibraltar trilogy. I think that was the first one that we all read here on the podcast. He writes, Michael McCollum writes old school hard sci-fi where, for me,
no otters drifting down rivers is what you're saying.
We'll talk about that in a minute. Yes.
Okay.
The joy is in his plot devices. I love being surprised, and I have always found Michael's work to be full of delightful moments. And to your point, Leo, speaking of sci-fi, I told our listeners that there would be the first episode of a new Star Trek series that I had great hopes for, Strange New Worlds, premiering last Thursday. It did. I watched it, and I loved it.
Oh, it's very much in the old school. Every episode has a beginning, middle, and end. There's a moral at the end. Very much like the original series, I thought. There's even apparently, a fist fight with aliens.
You got to have that.
Yeah. No red shirt guys, but other than that.
Spock gets to do his neck tweak.
Vulcan,
in order to
and
knock
gets a little line,
out.
A good line off on it, too.
Yeah. So we do have a young Spock and a young Uhura.
Spock is perfect, I have to say.
Yes.
And we have yet to see, but they mentioned, I don't know if you noticed this, a Lieutenant Kirk on board.
Oh no! Well, no, he did come on board toward the end.
Oh, did we see him?
He had a. I believe that our Kirk, James T. Kirk, had a brother, as I recall.
Oh.
And I think that he when they talked about Lieutenant Kirk, I thought what?
Yeah.
But it wasn't James.
And a young Nurse Chapel.
Yes, a young Nurse Chapel. Anyway, Lori was a bit confused about the timeline on this, and I had explained to her that this was a prequel to the original Kirk series,
but only 15 years before, right?
Because Pike was the previous captain of the Enterprise,
right,
to whom Spock had loyalty,
right,
which superseded his own Captain Kirk at the time and the Federation. Spock stole the Enterprise,
right,
in that episode,
right,
and boy was Kirk pissed off.
Was a pilot, wasn't it?
It was a pilot that was never aired.
The pilot that was never aired. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. Anyway, I loved it.
Somebody's asking, is it the alternate timeline? It is not the new reboot timeline. It is the original series timeline, right?
It is a prequel.
It's a prequel.
Yes.
It is not this new rebooted movie timeline.
Right.
This is very traditionalist. except for the graphics are updated, you know.
Oh,
the bridge looks nice.
Something about me, I don't know. I was getting choked up at various points. It's just it is so exactly right so far.
Spock is perfect, I think, in it. He's just very Spocky.
Yes, and I like Pike. I think he's got like the right
good hair.
Mixture.
He's got good hair. Yep.
Yeah, and he's like humility and okay, fine. Yeah. Anyway, I'm very 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 hopeful. We're only going to get 10 episodes. So if you wanted to, first of all, you could sign up if you wanted to pay Paramount, $5 a month or something for the 3 months that it'll be airing.
Yeah.
Or if you really wanted to be tricky, they offer you 5 free days. So you could wait for 3 months. Get your 5 3-day days, binge it during that time.
That's a lot of Star Trek.
That is.
It's a little, I'm going to say, a little cornball. Because I think, really, it is so true to the original series that it has that, it's not modern in the sense that, you know, there's not enough, it's kind of corny like the original series was.
And unlike me.
Yeah, I think people who like the original series will love it because it's much more in that spirit than even TNG or Discovery or any of the other more modern stuff.
In discussing some of the newer shows, some writer said, this is not your father's Star Trek. And my point is, this is your father's Star Trek.
Absolutely is your father's Star Trek.
Yeah. And I apparently that's what I want because Discovery was like a sped up video game.
Yeah.
You know, it was not well. And I do like that episodic format where you don't have to like
each one
last time.
Yeah.
Yes.
No previously. Yeah.
Now it also is the case that the phrase Picard season 2 rhymes nicely with "and I hate Q." God, do I hate Q.
I never liked him either.
I always have, and it turns out I still do.
Yeah.
He is an annoying fly in the ointment, and I suppose that I'm not a huge fan of John DeLancey, the actor, but we're watching the second season. We'll finish it tonight. We have 2 episodes left. It's better than the first one only because the first one was so horrible. And I heard that the second one was better. It's like, okay, but it's got Q.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you just can't have a really annoying, omnipotent alien who wants to, you know, get in Picard's face all the time. It's just annoying. So anyway, there were also too many dumb scenes, which it had very much had the sense that they were trying to draw the episode out to fill the hour. So I don't know. I'm very capable of disliking something that has Star Trek in its name, even something that has Jean-Luc Picard. Strange New Worlds, I thought was great.
Lisa said, I don't want any more of the ugly old bald Captain Kirk captain. I want the young hot captain. And I think Pike fits this, although she really, I think she really wants Shatner back. no more the bald old guy. That's it.
I got to give Bill Shatner credit for hanging around.
Legend.
And legendary. He is wonderful. When I was over at IMDb, because I wanted to update for the show notes, the current ranking of Strange New Worlds, it is at 8.3 out of 10.
That's
a very good rating. And it's going up. That's what you want to see. You want to see them going up after the actual show has been out for a while. What I stumbled on was the official trailer for the new Avatar movie called Avatar: The Way of Water. And apparently, this is number 2. It sure took Cameron a long time to get number 2 out, but number 3 is already in post-production, 4 is filming, and 5 is in the pipe. So we're going to get a bunch of Avatars, and I mean, it looked astonishing. I remember when I was watching the first Avatar, I just sat there thinking, how do you make this movie? How do you make this? I mean, it was just an astonishing piece of visualization. But this sort of looks like the first one. And, you know, okay, I guess maybe a new story for the kiddies, I'm afraid. I'm not sure that it's going to, you know, but, you know, Cameron has never disappointed me. I mean, he gave us the Terminator, Aliens, the second one, The Abyss, True Lies, Titanic, Dark Angel. That's where we saw Jessica Alba. Ooh, baby. And Avatar. So, yeah.
It's a mixed bag, I think.
I think. Yeah. And Leo, our last break, and then we're going to talk about what is that passkeys thing.
Okay. Our show today brought to you by, it's funny because I was just doing it for my daughter, sending her a credit card via Privacy. Privacy is awesome. Awesome. Privacy.com. It's a tool that lets you use credit cards without a thought as to the security. Why? Because these are credit cards that are either one-time only burner cards. Use them. It's gone. It's done. I actually don't make too many of those. I'm much more likely to use the merchant locked cards. So you make a card at privacy.com, and they have plugins for Chrome and Firefox, so it's actually very easy, or you can log in, make the card. It appears as a real credit card with a expiration date 5 years in the future. That's convenient. A real security number and all of that. But it's locked to the merchant in the case of the merchant card, which means when I made a card for Amazon, only Amazon could ever use it. I do this all the time because I don't want, if that card gets stolen, it can't be used. It gets declined immediately. I can also control how much is spent. I can set spending limits per day, per month, per year, per transaction. I can use these. In fact, I always do. In fact, I strongly recommend you do for recurring transactions, subscriptions, because it seems to be the case. Now, this is not true for subscribing to Club Twit, but it does seem to be the case for other things that you subscribe to, especially recurring ones. They don't make it easy to cancel, right? My worst one is, you have to call to cancel. It was so easy to create the subscription online. Oh, but you got to call to cancel. Well, if you use privacy cards for all your subscriptions, as I do, don't bother canceling. Press pause. Or if you want, burn the card. Destroy it. They can never use it. They can never get any more money out of you. You're done. It's it. It's simple. It's the best way to use credit cards. Plus, privacy masks your real bank information. Obviously, they have to have it so they can debit you, but they don't pass it along to the vendors. So I can use, and I often do, John Doe, 123 Main Street, Anytown, USA, 10000 as my, address and zip code, and it goes through. Privacy knows it's me. They're not worried about it, and the merchant doesn't get any information about me. This is a great way to clean up your digital hygiene, to use with confidence credit cards online, even at shady spots that you would never dare use a credit card. It's such a great way to do it. And is it easy to share? Yes. So from time to time, my mom, 89 years old, she cooked for me my whole childhood. I want to buy her dinner. So I said, well, Mom, I'm going to send you a card. And by the way, you don't tell it what the merchant is ahead of time. So I said, I'm going to send you a card. Use it for Grubhub, DoorDash, whatever delivery service you want to use. But just be aware that once you use it, it can't be used for anybody else. So the minute you use it for somebody, it's now locked into that merchant. That's how it gets locked. I love that. That's real convenient. And I don't have to copy and paste the card number and all the information into a text message. That's not safe. There's a share. You make the card on the privacy.com website, and there's a button that says share it. What's the email address? They take care of the rest completely securely. She doesn't need an account. She just gets the information she needs securely directly from Privacy. For your own accounting, the account summaries make it easy for you to track how much you're spending every month or somebody else is spending. I know exactly how much Mom spends at Grubhub. There's a summary page easy for budgeting. You can filter by date, by spend. You even can tag your cards so you can sort by tagging. makes it very easy to figure out where your money's going. And there are a number of different payment plans. It's free, absolutely free. But I pay, I think, $10 a month for a pro plan because I get 1% back. That means, given how much I use my privacy card, I make money. I get more cash back, much more than I spend for the pro account. So just something to pay attention to when you sign up. Protect your financial identity on the internet using virtual cards. Go to privacy.com/security now. As I said, you can get the free account. Try it out. You'll automatically get $5 to spend on their first purchase. It's free forever. Always free. But you may want to look at the other plans down the road because it's worked out very well for me. If you use it a lot, do that. Privacy.com/security now. Just the best way to use credit cards online. Nobody ever knows anything about me. I can cancel it at any time. I can pause it. I can unpause it. That's a really nice feature. I just love it. Privacy. My daughter said, I want Spotify. I said, well, look, here. I just sent her the card. Her privacy card. I said, buy the family plan. So, and add me and your brother and everybody so everybody can use it. And that way we'll all benefit. And but she has the card. The card's in her name. I think it's just a really good way to do it. Privacy.com/security now. Secure, private. Great. Okay, Steve. By the way, I did want to mention, you didn't like book 4 of the Babaverse. That's where I was talking about otters floating down the river. I liked it. I liked it quite a bit. So, but now I'm waiting for book 5. Love the Babaverse.
Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Now, let's talk about this Fido thing, because I really want to get your take on it.
So, Ars Technica's headline was Apple, Google, and Microsoft want to kill the password with passkey standard. Instead of a password, devices would look for your phone over Bluetooth. Bleeping Computer said Microsoft, Apple, and Google to support Fido passwordless logins. The Record said Google, Apple, and Microsoft to expand support for passwordless sign-in standard. And it made the headlines in all of the tech press. And all of these headlines popped up last Thursday, May 5th, which, as I said at the top of the show, was not only Cinco de Mayo, but also World Password Day. And the news of and questions about this new passkeys was the most tweeted to me item of the past week, with many of our listeners wanting to know what it was and what I thought. Having spent 7 years of my life designing, implementing, demonstrating, and proving a complete working solution to this need, I have a good grasp of the problem domain. So I dug into this passkeys news by going to the source, as I always endeavor to. I first read the Fido Alliance's May 5th press release, which was titled Apple, Google, and Microsoft Commit to Expanded Support for Fido Standard to Accelerate Availability of Passwordless Sign-ins. This was the press release that everyone else was quoting in the news. It appeared that whoever wrote it was being paid by the word, since it went on and on to make sure that its reader would come away knowing that all pre-Fido systems were bad and Fido was the cure. At this point, it appears that regardless of whether or not it turns out to be the cure, it will at least be the next thing we try. And I'm in the same boat as all of our listeners. We're all avid users and consumers of the internet. So we're all hoping that the industry knows what it's doing. But that press release wasn't going to get the job done. Fortunately, it linked to the description of the Fido Alliance white paper titled Multi-Device Fido Credentials. The description of the paper that links to it said, the Fido standards, together with their companion WebAuthn specification, are on the cusp of an important new development. Evolutionary changes to the standards proposed by the Fido Alliance and the W3C WebAuthn community aim to markedly improve the usability and deployability of FIDO-based authentication mechanisms. As a result, FIDO-based secure authentication technology will, for the first time, be able to replace passwords as the dominant form of authentication on the internet. What a concept. In this paper, they say, we explain how FIDO and WebAuthn standards previously enabled low-cost deployments of authentication mechanisms with very high assurance levels. While this has proved an attractive alternative to traditional smart card authentication and even opened the door to high assurance authentication in the consumer space, we have not attained large-scale adoption of FIDO-based authentication in the consumer space. We explain how the introduction of multi-device FIDO credentials will enable FIDO technology to supplant passwords for many consumer use cases as they make FIDO credentials available to users wherever they need them, even if they replace their device. Okay, so I have a link in the show notes to the PDF for anyone who wants the raw material. Obviously, this descriptive overview still doesn't tell us what we want to know. So I dug into the white paper. We get the executive summary, followed by a brief history of online authentication, then a section titled FIDO Starting from the Top, followed by WebAuthn Level 3 Bringing Up the Bottom. So this brings us to the bottom of page 4 of the PDF, and we begin to frame the problem as follows. The explanation explains, FIDO-based solutions can also increase the security of consumer two-factor authentication by providing phishing resistance, regardless of whether those use cases care about hardware-based sign-in credentials or not. Now, I should mention that FIDO was always hardware-based, which has been the problem that they've been struggling with, is that the FIDO authentication standard was you will have a hardware dongle, a token, a something, which because it's hardware, because it's physical, it cannot be spoofed. It cannot be, you know, no one in Russia can get the contents of what you have in your thing you're holding in your hand
The YubiKey said there's some that are FIDO2 YubiKeys. That's what you mean.
Yes.
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 Yeah.
Yes. And so
that's good. That's good security. No one would deny that, right?
You could argue it's the best.
The gold
security.
Standard. Yeah.
Yes. The problem is it's physical.
Yeah, you can't make people buy keys. $50 keys.
Yes. Exactly. The benefit is it's physical. The problem is it's physical. And so where they say they said FIDO-based solutions can also increase the security of consumer two-factor authentication by providing phishing resistance regardless of whether those use cases care about hardware-based sign-in credentials or not. In other words, they're saying we're giving up. We're going to back down from the position we had taken. I mean, you could still use hardware-based sign-in credentials, but now you're not going to have to. We're not going to make you have to have a hardware dongle. And this has been sort of in the air for a couple of years, right? There's been talk about being able to use your phone as your FIDO authenticator. So this notion isn't completely new. It's been happening. They said, however, we have observed limited adoption in this latter category, especially in the consumer space, because of the perceived inconvenience of physical security keys, buying, registering, carrying, recovering, and the challenges consumers face with platform authenticators as a second factor. For example, having to re-enroll each new device. No easy ways to recover from lost or stolen devices. They said, while these drawbacks can make FIDO-based solutions, whether based on physical security keys or platform authenticators, and I should explain this phrase, platform authenticators, that just means your smartphone or your laptop. That's what they're calling that a platform authenticator as opposed to a physical security key. So drawbacks can make FIDO-based solutions, whether based on physical security keys or platform authenticators, a tricky proposition for users already accustomed to two-factor authentication. They present an even higher barrier to adoption for users who don't or don't want to use two-factor authentication at all and are stuck with passwords. And so, finally, we get down to it. The white paper explains, the FIDO Alliance and the W3C Web Often Working Group are proposing to address these gaps in a new version, which they call Level 3, of the Web Often specification. They said two proposed advances in particular bear mentioning. And so here they are, one and two. Number one, using your phone as a roaming authenticator. That's the first of these proposed advances. They said a smartphone is something that end users typically already have. Virtually all consumer space two-factor authentication mechanisms today already make use of the user's smartphone. The problem is that they do this in a phishable manner. You may inadvertently enter a one-time password on a phisher's site, or you may approve a login prompt on your smartphone, not realizing that your browser is pointed at the phishing site and not the intended destination. The proposed additions to the FIDO Web Often specs define a protocol that uses Bluetooth to communicate between the user's phone, which becomes the FIDO authenticator, and the device from which the user is trying to authenticate, you know, your laptop, for example. Bluetooth, they say, requires physical proximity, which means that we now have a phishing-resistant way to leverage the user's phone during authentication.
Yeah, the hacker has to be in physical proximity, which is good. Right, because Bluetooth is not the most secure. Well, Go ahead.
Of course, Squirrel solved this with a QR code that you let your phone see, as we know.
Right.
They said, with this addition to the FIDO Web Often standards, two-factor deployments that currently use the user's phone as a second factor will be able to upgrade to a higher security level, phishing resistance, without the need for the user to carry a specialized piece of authentication hardware, parens, security keys. Oh, thank God. So, yes, we'll be able to use our phones. Wonderful. That was point one. Here's point two. Multi-device FIDO credentials. Okay. They say, we expect that FIDO authenticator vendors, in particular, those of authenticators built into OS platforms. This is, we've heard the names, right? Apple, Google, Microsoft. Will adapt their authenticator implementations such that a FIDO credential can survive device loss. In other words, and again, it hasn't been done yet, but this is what they expect. We expect that FIDO authenticator vendors, blah, blah, blah. In other words, if the user had set up a number of FIDO credentials for different relying parties, and, you know, relying parties is a term of art in this whole identity space, on their phone, if the user had set up a number of FIDO credentials for different relying parties on their phone, and notice that in FIDO, you need a credential per relying party. That is, a FIDO credential for Amazon, a FIDO credential for PayPal, a FIDO credential for Facebook, a FIDO credential for Google, blah, blah, blah. One each. It's a one-for-one mapping in FIDO. And then, they say, got a new phone. That user should be able to expect that their FIDO credentials will be available on their new phone. This means that users don't need passwords anymore as they move from device to device. Their FIDO credentials are already there, ready to be used for phishing-resistant authentication. Okay, now I'll just pause to note that I solved this problem with one-time password authenticators with my sheaf of printed QR codes, right? We were talking about that last week. When I'm enrolling on a site that uses a one that offers me second-factor authentication with a one-time password, and it shows me the QR code, which I can then capture with my authenticator on my phone, I also print the paper out, and it's securely stored. I have a sheaf of them for all the places I use two-factor authentication, so that, yeah, if I need to set up a new device that doesn't sync in some fashion with the authenticator in my phone, I can do that. It's offline. No one in Russia can get to it. It's very secure. But yeah, it's a little burdensome. I had to do that. Lots of people don't. And then they get stuck if their authenticator won't export or transport and sync. So they say, for these multi-device FIDO credentials. This is their term. Multi-device FIDO credentials just means cloud sync. That's all that is. Multi-device FIDO credentials. It is the OS platform's responsibility to ensure that the credentials are available where the user needs them. And also note that some companies are calling FIDO credentials pass keys in their product implementations, in particular when those FIDO credentials may be multi-device credentials. So in other words, just for the record, pass keys is not a term of art in FIDO, and I imagine that the company that has a trademark on pass key is not very happy. You know, a lot of people noted that the government started to use the term shields up for one of their things. And it's like, I don't care. But exactly. So they say, just like password managers do with passwords, the underlying OS platform will sync the cryptographic keys that belong to a FIDO credential from device to device. This means that the security and availability of a user's synced credential depends on the security of the underlying OS platforms, parens, Google's, Apple's, Microsoft's, etc., authentication mechanism for their online accounts, and on the security method for reinstating access when all old devices are lost. While this may not always meet the bar for use cases that require physical key level security, they write, it is a huge improvement in security compared to passwords. Each of the referenced platforms apply sophisticated risk analysis and employ implicit or explicit second factors in authentication, thus giving two-factor-like protections to many of their users. So this is FIDO saying, well, it's not as good as physical keys. We're kind of annoyed. But look, it's going to work. Like maybe someone will actually use FIDO because we're going to allow cloud syncing in this level 3 LEP mode. And the people who are doing the syncing are, you know, being responsible enough. So they said this shift from letting every service fend for themselves with their own password-based authentication system to relying on the higher security of the platform's authentication mechanisms is how we can meaningfully reduce the internet's over-reliance on passwords at a massive scale.
In other words, they're saying that we will rely upon the user authenticating to their own device, smartphone or desktop, with biometrics or whatever, rather than authenticating to each remote site individually. And yes, that sounds familiar. Finally, they say syncing FIDO credentials, cryptographic keys between devices, may not always be possible. For example, if the user is using a new device from a different vendor, which doesn't sync with the user's other existing devices. In such cases, the existence of the above-mentioned standardized Bluetooth protocol enables a convenient and secure alternative. Colon, if the FIDO credential isn't readily available on the device from which the user is trying to authenticate, the user will likely have a device, for example, a phone, nearby that does have the credential. So, in other words, if you're using Windows and iOS won't sync to Windows, then you can use Bluetooth on your iOS device to get the credential over into Windows. They said the user will then be able to use their existing device to facilitate authentication from their new device. Okay, so it appears that what this press release and these so-called passkeys, which is, again, as the white paper explains, don't actually have anything to do with FIDO, that is, the term doesn't. It's just the introduction of cloud syncing among devices to facilitate the transport of one's collection of FIDO credentials from one device to the next. The other piece, well, and in the case of device loss, when you get a new one, you resync with the cloud and you get all of your FIDO credentials back. The other piece is that the FIDO Alliance appears to have formally given up on the idea that we're all going to go out and purchase a hardware FIDO token when we all already own a smartphone that can serve the same purpose. The use of a possibly available Bluetooth link allows one smartphone to be used to authenticate to a website on a desktop that does not contain a FIDO authenticator with one's credentials. And as we said, for clarity, that's what Squirrel provides for with a QR code and the smartphone's camera. And yes, speaking of Squirrel, I know that the heads of everyone out there who understands Squirrel is exploding right now because FIDO still falls very far short of providing the complete solution that Squirrel offers. But having moved from simple usernames and passwords to password managers and multi-factor authentication, and then to OAuth third-party authentication, we're now going to get FIDO. Though it will apparently be popularly called passkeys, from the samples I've seen online, it appears that it will still be necessary to first identify oneself to the website being authenticated to. So FIDO with passkeys replaces the password, but unfortunately not the username. So it will continue to be somewhat more cumbersome in that way. The way FIDO's crypto works is that it randomly synthesizes a public and private key pair for each and every website the user wishes to authenticate with. And it gives that site the public key to retain, while the FIDO authenticator stores the matching private key for each subsequent use for re-authenticating. So it's this collection of individual private authentication keys, which are now being called passkeys, that Apple, Google, and Microsoft will be obtaining and synchronizing in the cloud for their users. This provides for same platform, cross-device FIDO credential synchronization, which is crucial for FIDO since each new website authentication creates another public-private key pair. And it provides for credential recovery in the event of a device's loss, and that's certainly needed to create a practical system. As we know, I went a different way with Squirrel. Squirrel uses a single master key
which can be printed and stored safely. Or it could be loaded in the cloud if you wanted, whatever. From that one key, it deterministically synthesizes unique per-site public and private key pairs based upon the website's domain name. And like FIDO, it gives each website the public key to use for future authentication. But unlike FIDO, there is no growing collection of randomly synthesized per-site private keys that need to be retained and cloud-synced among devices. So there's no need to back up a large collection of private keys to the cloud or anywhere. The only thing a squirrel user ever needs for their identity to be secure and fully recoverable for all websites is one piece of paper. And if you have multiple identities on multiple devices, you can log in for the first time on some other device that has your same squirrel identity. And when you log on a different device, the identity works because multiple devices all synthesize the same private key. So, backing off from that, overall, this whole big announcement of passkeys appears to have mostly been a World Password Day timed press event without much technology to back it up. We're not getting Squirrel, we're getting FIDO. And that means we need cloud synchronized passkeys to make FIDO's use practical. The good news is we're going to get it. I'll be interested to see how the login flow functions. The other big thing FIDO is missing is it doesn't identify you to the site. You still have to first identify yourself. Then FIDO replaces your password. Squirrel did both, which was way more convenient. But anyway, we're not getting Squirrel. We're getting FIDO. And passkeys makes FIDO feasible because you have to be able to, since you are synthesizing completely random keys for every site you visit, you've got to collect them. You've somehow got to cross-device sync them. And Apple, Google, and Microsoft will be taking care of that for us.
So it sounds like it's kind of less secure than if you used a YubiKey, I guess.
Yes. This is absolutely FIDO Group, the FIDO Alliance, compromising themselves down from their ivory tower. Because nobody wanted FIDO.
Right.
Yes, nobody was going to do it. Yes, high level. I know that there are Google employees who use their Titan keys to do things. But
it's not going to succeed if everybody. But see, that's my other issue is not everybody has a smart device. I guess would this work if you didn't have,
it's always possible to still use a username and password.
Oh, okay.
That will never go away.
Okay.
Never.
Which means
never,
that's
never
what people are going to do.
Yes. Yeah.
So.
My favorite example, Leo, is the person who said, "Well, I don't need a password manager." And I said, you can't be using the same password everywhere. And she said, "Oh no, I don't." And I said,
How you do that then?
And she said, "Well, when I'm creating an account, I just bang on the keyboard a lot." And I said, "Okay." And I said, "So how do you log in again?" She said,
"I forgot."
Well, there's a little line there that says, "I forgot my password."
Yeah.
She said, "And I never knew it, so I did forget it."
Yeah.
And then she said, "Then they send me a link, and I log in with that." And
that's fairly secure, right? I mean, honestly, yeah.
Well, it uses an email confirmation in order to reassert that you.
As long as you don't lose control of your email, you're okay.
Correct. And that is the segue to next week's picture of the week, which is already in the document waiting to be displayed.
You don't have anything else, but that's there.
That's
I
right.
I love it. Obviously, Squirrel would be much more secure, but Squirrel has a similar problem, which is it is not trivially easy to use. And for that reason, I think people are going to fall back to a password for almost anything.
Yeah.
Single sign-on is good. You know, I use Microsoft now for login to Windows. As you know, sends your phone an authenticator, sends it a two-digit number, and you say, yeah, I know that number, and you're in. That seems like, is that the same thing as this FIDO thing? It's similar.
Well, so it's specific to Microsoft.
That's right.
And
that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we're looking for a broad-based solution which solves the phishing and the I forgot my password problem.
Right.
Which is, you know, easy to use. The fact is, we'll have to see what the flow looks like. It is certainly easy to do, you know, log in with Facebook, log in with Google. We know that that's horrific from a tracking and privacy standpoint, right? Because
yeah. Oh, I don't do that.
You're bouncing
I've stopped
through
doing
them.
That entirely, yes.
Oh, my God. Yeah. And, in fact, I did hear you on Twit last Sunday talking about how you were finally thinking maybe you should be taking privacy a little more seriously.
Yes,
than you,
I admitted I was wrong. And that because these data brokers selling information about who visited Planned Parenthood over the past week for $160 bucks. And what that does is it puts you if you live in Texas and there are now other states and soon it might
criminalizing
be 23 other states.
Criminalizing interstate travel for the purpose of terminating a pregnancy.
For $160 bucks, anybody, the way this Texas law works, anybody can go after you. So there's now probably a brisk business of people buying that information and then suing you or law enforcement in Tennessee, for instance, going after you. Or I guess it's Louisiana. In any event, it suddenly became obvious that the government is now starting to go after people for things that they shouldn't be and – it is now dangerous to, you know, leave this stuff on, unfortunately.
And that's really, I think, that is, you're right. That's the takeaway, is that given a certain set of existing laws, you could argue that there, with those laws, there's a reduced risk from lack of privacy.
Yeah.
But if the laws change...
Well, that's the problem. Exactly.
Then suddenly... The previous assumptions no longer hold
exactly.
under the new regime.
Exactly.
And that's the danger.
If you trust the government, no problem. I no longer trust the government, so problem.
Yeah.
And that's too bad.
Yeah.
But now we have to pay more attention. So you've been right all along. I was a wide-eyed optimist. I am no longer. Steve, thank you as always. It's always eye-opening and always fascinating. If you do not tune in every Tuesday to Security Now, you really ought to. You're listening today. I think you know now. Several ways you can do this. You can watch live. if you happen to be around 1:30 p.m. Pacific, 4:30 Eastern, 20:30 UTC on a Tuesday, you could just go to live.twit.tv. There's a live audio and video stream there. You could watch that. If you're watching live, chat live at irc.twit.tv. Of course, Club Twit members can also watch live inside the club. They can chat about it inside the club. There's a lot of other benefits. $7 a month, ad-free versions of all the shows, so there's no tracking. If you really want privacy, twit.tv/clubtwit is a good place to go. After the fact, you can online go to twit.tv/SN. That's our website. Steve also has the show at his website, grc.com. In fact, he has two unique formats. He has a good hand-contrived transcripts by Elaine Ferris, who listens to this whole show. She's listening even now and writes it down and then puts it in a transcript. That's really handy for searching. You can also get a 16 kilobit version for the bandwidth impaired, and of course the full 64 kilobit audio, also available at grc.com. If you're over there, you know, it might be a good idea to pick up a copy of SpinRite, current version 6.0. If you buy today, you'll get a copy of 6.1 when it comes out, but you'll also participate in the final stages of that creation. And everybody who has mass storage really needs SpinRite, the world's best mass storage maintenance and recovery utility. There's lots of other great stuff. GRC.com. You can also leave them feedback there. GRC.com/feedback. Maybe the better way to do it is through Twitter. He has his DMs open, as the kids say. You can slide into them at SGGRC on the Twitter. SGGRC. We have copies of the show at the website, as I mentioned. You know, the easiest thing might be just to subscribe. Both Steve and I have links to the RSS feed. You put that into your podcast client, and you'll get to the show the minute it's available each and every Tuesday, so you can listen at your own leisure, at your own pace. I know some people like to listen at 1.5. In which case, when you watch live, I just got to warn you, we will sound drunk talking at normal speed, but that's the side effect of listening at double speed. Thank you, Steve. Have a wonderful day, and we'll see you next time on Security Now.
Righto. Bye.
Live long and prosper.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor of Ad Astra magazine, and each week I'm joined by Tarek Malik, the editor-in-chief over at space.com, in our new This Week in Space podcast. Every Friday, Tarek and I take a deep dive into the stories that define the new space age. What's NASA up to? When will Americans once again set foot on the moon? And how about those samples from the Perseverance rover? When are those coming home? What the heck has Elon Musk done now? In addition to all the latest and greatest in space exploration, we'll take an occasional look at bits of spaceflight history that you probably never heard of, and all with an eye towards having a good time along the way. Check us out in your favorite podcatcher.
Security Now.